Chapter 85. Some account of the ship, first and foremost. I must give some account of the Julia herself, or Little Jewel, as the sailors familiarly styled her. She was a small bark of a beautiful model, something more than 200 tons, Yankee built and very old. Fitted for a privateer out of a New England port during the War of 1812, as he had been captured at sea by a British cruiser, and, after seeing all sorts of service, was at last employed as a government packet in the Australian seas. Being condemned, however, about 2 years previous, she was purchased at auction by a house in Sydney, who, after some slight repairs, dispatched her on the present voyage. Notwithstanding the repairs, she was still in a miserable plight. The lower masts were said to be unsound, the standing rigging was much worn, and, in some places, even the bulwarks were quite rotten. Still, she was tolerably tight, and but little more than the ordinary pumping of a morning served to keep her free. But all this had nothing to do with her sailing. At that, brave Little Jewel, plump Little Jewel, was a witch. Blow high, or blow low, she was always ready for the breeze, and when she dashed the waves from her prow, and pranced, and pawed the sea, you never thought of her patched sails and blistered hull. How the fleet creature would fly before the wind, rolling, now and then, to be sure, but in very playfulness. Sailing to windward, no gale could bow her over. With spars erect, she looked right up into the wind's eye, and so she, but after all, Little Jewel was not to be confided in. Lively enough, and playful she was, but on that very account the more to be distrusted. Who knew, but that like some vivacious old mortal all at once sinking into a decline, she might, some dark night, spring a leak, and carry us all to the bottom. However, she played us no such ugly trick, and therefore, I wrong Little Jewel in supposing it. As he had a free roving commission. According to her papers she might go whither she pleased, whaling, sealing, or anything else. Sperm whaling, however, was what she relied upon, though, as yet, only two fish had been brought alongside. The day they sailed out of Sydney Heads, the ship's company, all told, numbered some 32 souls. Now, they mustered about 20, the rest had deserted. Even the three junior mates who had headed the whaleboats were gone. And of the four harpooners, only one was left, a wild New Zealander, or Ori as his countrymen are more commonly called in the Pacific. But this was not all. More than half the seamen remaining were more or less unwell from a long sojourn in a dissipated port, some of them wholly unfit for duty, one or two dangerously ill, and the rest managing to stand their watch, though they could do but little. The captain was a young Cockney, who, a few years before, had emigrated to Australia, and, by some favoritism or other, had procured the command of the vessel, though in no wise competent. He was essentially a landsman, and though a man of education, no more meant for the sea than a hairdresser. Hence everybody made fun of him. They called him the cabin boy, paper jack, and half a dozen other undignified names. In truth, the men made no secret of the derision in which they held him, and as for the slender gentleman himself, he knew it all very well, and bore himself with becoming meekness. Holding as little intercourse with them as possible, he left everything to the chief mate, who, as the story went, had been given his captain in charge. Yet, despite his apparent unobtrusiveness, the silent captain had more to do with the men than they thought. In short, although one of your sheepish-looking fellows, he had a sort of still, timid cunning, which no one would have suspected, and which, for that very reason, was all the more active. So the bluff mate, who always thought he did what he pleased, was occasionally made a tool of, and some obnoxious measures which he carried out, in spite of all growlings, were little thought to originate with the dapper little fellow in nankeen jacket and white canvas pumps. But, to all appearance, at least, the mate had everything his own way. Indeed, in most things this was actually the case, and it was quite plain that the captain stood in awe of him. So far as courage, seamanship, and a natural aptitude for keeping riotous spirits in subjection were concerned, no man was better qualified for his vocation than John German. He was the very beau ideal of the efficient race of short, thick-set men. His hair curled in little rings of iron gray all over his round bullet head. As for his countenance, it was strongly marked, deeply pitted with the smallpox. For the rest, there was a fierce little squint out of one eye, the nose had a rakish twist to one side, while his large mouth, and great white teeth, looked absolutely sharkish when he laughed. In a word, no one, after getting a fair look at him, would ever think of improving the shape of his nose, wanting in symmetry as it was. Notwithstanding his pugnacious looks, however, German had a heart as big as a bullock's, that you saw at a glance. Such was our mate, but he had one failing. He abhorred all weak infusions, and cleaved manfully to strong drink. But at all times he was more or less under the influence of it. Taken in moderate quantities, I believe, in my soul, it did a man like him good. Brightened his eyes, swept the cobwebs out of his brain, and regulated his pulse. But the worst of it was, that sometimes he drank too much, and a more obstreperous fellow than German in his cups, you seldom came across. He was always for having a fight, but the very men he flogged, loved him as a brother, for he had such an irresistibly good-natured way of knocking them down, that no one could find it in his heart to bear malice against him. So much for stout little German. All English wheelmen are bound by law to carry a physician, who, of course, is rated a gentleman, and lives in the cabin, with nothing but his professional duties to attend to, but incidentally he drinks flip and plays cards with the captain. There was such a worthy aboard of the Julia, but, curious to tell, he lived in the forecastle with the men. And this was the way it happened. In the early part of the voyage the doctor and the captain lived together as pleasantly as could be. To say nothing of many a can they drank over the cabin transom, both of them had read books, and one of them had traveled, so their stories never flagged. But once on a time they got into a dispute about politics, and the doctor, moreover, getting into a rage, drove home an argument with his fist, and left the captain on the floor literally silenced. This was carrying it with a high hand, so he was shut up in his stateroom for 10 days, and left to meditate on bread and water, and the impropriety of flying into a passion. Smarting under his disgrace, he undertook, a short time after his liberation, to leave the vessel clandestinely at one of the islands, but was brought back ignominiously, and again shut up. Being set at large for the second time, he vowed he would not live any longer with the captain, and went forward with his chests among the sailors, where he was received with open arms as a good fellow and an injured man. I must give some further account of him, for he figures largely in the narrative. His early history, like that of many other heroes, was enveloped in the profoundest obscurity, though he threw out hints of a patrimonial estate, a nabob uncle, and an unfortunate affair which sent him a-roving. All that was known, however, was this. He had gone out to Sydney as assistant surgeon of an emigrant ship. On his arrival there, he went back into the country, and after a few months' wanderings, returned to Sydney penniless, and entered as doctor aboard of the Julia. His personal appearance was remarkable. He was over 6 feet high, a tower of bones, with a complexion absolutely colorless, fair hair, and a light unscrupulous gray eye, twinkling occasionally at the very devil of mischief. Among the crew, he went by the name of the Long Doctor, or more frequently still, Dr. Long Ghost. And from whatever high estate Dr. Long Ghost might have fallen, he had certainly at some time or other spent money, drunk burgundy, and associated with gentlemen. As for his learning, he quoted Virgil, and talked of Hobbes of Malmesbury, beside repeating poetry by the canto, especially Hudibras. He was, moreover, a man who had seen the world. In the easiest way imaginable, he could refer to an amour he had in Palermo, his lion hunting before breakfast among the Kaffirs, and the quality of the coffee, to be drunk in Muscat, and about these places, and 100 others, he had more anecdotes than I can tell of. Then such mellow old songs as he sang, in a voice so round and racy, the real juice of sound. How such notes came forth from his lank body was a constant marvel. Upon the whole, Long Ghost was as entertaining a companion as one could wish, and to me in the Julia, an absolute godsend. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.